I have the hip movement of a toy soldier. I can't even do the white man dance.
The what?
The white man dance? You know, the dance that black guys do to make fun of white guys who can't dance? Only problem is you gotta have rhythm to mimic the guys who have none. I don't even have enough to do that.
She crossed her arms.
I'm waiting. Why don't you just spit in one hand and wish in the other and see which one gets full the quickest? She scratched her head, then smiled.
Where'd you hear that?
Something my dad used to say when I'd ask him for money for the weekend.
Sounds like a rough relationship.
A bit. So, are you going to dance or what? I turned, did my best John Travolta staying alive imitation, followed by that weird mop bucket thing that guys do with their arms and hips. I topped it off with my YMCA imitation and a Michael Jackson moonwalk, spin, and hat tilt. When I finished, she was doubled over in her bag, laughing so hard she couldn't talk. Finally, she held out a hand.
Stop! Don't!
I think I just peed a little. The laughter felt good. Real good. And as much as I wanted a satellite phone, a helicopter ride out of there, and a surgical suite to fix her leg, the laughter was worth all of that put together. Napoleon looked at us like we were nuts. Especially me. She lay back, breathing, half laughing. I zipped up my jacket. Rachel made us take lessons.
What?
Yep. Swing, tango, waltz, Viennese waltz, jitterbug, foxtrot, even a line dance or two.
You know how to do all those?
I nodded. Rachel said that due to all the running, my hip flexors are rather tight, making me somewhat rhythmically challenged. So I signed us up for dance lessons, a year's worth. Some of the most fun we ever had on dates.
So you really can dance?
With her. If I'm lucky, I'll get one dance out of Vince at our wedding. That's about it. I learned that I like dancing with my wife. Once I learn what to do, how to lead. I laughed. Once she let me, it wasn't so bad. It wasn't so embarrassing. Took the worry out of it. Let us have fun. Of course, after that, she wanted to dance at every party we ever attended.
And did you?
I nodded. I called it mercy dancing. And 99% of the time I had to do it with me having mercy on her. But it had its trade-off. I raised my eyebrows.
You need to talk to Vince when we get out of here.
I'll see what I can do. I gave her my jacket, which she stuffed inside her bag, stepped into the harness, and buckled myself in. Come on, we're burning daylight.
I've heard that before.
She snapped her fingers.
Where's that come from?
John Wayne, the Cowboys. She slid down in her bag.
You are getting more interesting with every day that passes.
Trust me, my rabbit's hat is just about empty.
I doubt that.
I strapped on my snowshoes and leaned into the sled, and it gave way across the frozen snow. I took two steps and she called to me.
Can I see that little dance move one more time?
I shook my hips, mopped the floor, tossed the pizza, spun the Q-tip, and spelled YMCA. She was howling, gently kicking her one good leg. We pulled out through the trees, bathed in the smell of evergreens and the sound of her laughter. Chapter 25. By lunchtime, we'd walked a mile and a half, and I was toast. My left foot was frozen, a bad sign, and because the last half mile was slightly uphill, the straps had been cutting into my shoulders, making my fingers numb. It's a good thing I wasn't scheduled to operate on anybody. We stopped for an hour alongside a small creek whose banks were frozen and swollen with snow. I pulled Ashley up beneath a tree, pulled off my wet shirt and hung it to dry. Letting the shirt freeze was actually good because it was easier to shake off ice than wring out sweat in this temperature. The tree's branches canopied out over the ground, protecting it from snow. It created a bowl effect. I slid Ashley down inside, flattened her out, and slid one of the branches slightly askew to let in more light.
Then I climbed into my bag where, warm and quiet, I slept for an hour. When I woke, I dressed, nibbled on some jerky, and stepped back into the harness. I dug a ramp of sorts to pull her out of the bowl beneath the tree. Once I got her up on flat ground again, I stamped my foot 5 or 6 times. It felt wet. Wet meant cold, and cold was bad, especially for toes. I'd need to watch this. Late in the afternoon, the sun poked through, heated things up slightly, which turned the snow more towards mush, wet and sticky. I'd take 2 or 3 steps, fall, bury myself in snow, climb out, take 2 or 3 more steps, bury myself again. This went on for a couple of hours. By nightfall, we'd come maybe 2.5 miles, a total of 3.5 or 4 from the crash site. Sometimes I'd take a minute's rest between steps, and yet it wasn't enough. Clouds spilled over the mountains. Nighttime fell quickly, and I could barely move. I was cold and soaking wet, but I didn't have the energy to make a fire. The little voice inside my head was telling me I couldn't keep this up for long. I needed to find a place to hole up tomorrow and rest the day. Ashley, too, was tired. She'd been bracing herself all day against the what-if or possible fall. That was taking its toll on her. We camped at a rock outcropping, a ledge that, given years of use by critters, had made somewhat of a cave. Good protection from the wind and snow, while also offering a 1-in-a-million view. I propped Ashley up against the wall, giving her the full effect of the panorama. She cracked her eyes open and said, "Wow, never seen anything like that." "Me neither," was all I could mutter. I sat down, totally zonked. "Would it be all right with you if we didn't have a fire tonight?" She nodded. I stripped out of my wet clothes and tried to hang what I could along the inside of the rock ledge. Even though the outside temperature was in the teens, my inner layer of capelline was dripping with sweat. I pulled on my only pair of boxer shorts, slipped into my bag, closed my eyes, and only then thought of my boots. If I didn't get my left boot dry, tomorrow would be a miserable day. I climbed out, grabbed handfuls of dead pine needles and small twigs, and built a teepee about 1 foot tall. I stacked the dry needles inside, along with a few branches still holding onto their dead needles. I knew I would only get 1 shot at this. I took out Grover's lighter, rubbed it between my palms for some reason that I can't explain, stuck it inside the teepee, and struck it. It sparked, but no flame. I shook it. "Come on, just 1 time." I struck it again. Nothing. "Last time." I struck it. A flame appeared, grabbed the pine needles, and was gone. The flame didn't last more than 1 second, but it was long enough to light the needles, which are incredibly flammable. If you've ever set a Christmas tree on fire, you know what I mean. I slowly fed more twigs into it, blowing lightly at the base. The fire grew. I fed more tinder into it, and once I felt like it had caught, I searched for larger sticks, maybe even a log. Dead on my feet, I found enough wood to feed the fire for a few hours, and stacked rocks alongside the edge to insulate it while creating an opening in the back so the heat could escape and waft in our direction. I set my boots at the base of a crack between 2 of the rocks, close enough to dry but not melt the rubber, peeled off my jacket, climbed into my bag, and fell asleep seconds after my head hit the ground. My last thought was knowing that Grover's lighter was finished. It had given us its last flame. Conditions continue to worsen. Wet clothes, wet feet, blisters, and little energy. We had cooked the mountain lion, but even at our current rate of eating it sparingly, we might have 2 days left. That included Napoleon. If we didn't feed him, maybe 3. Problem was, I couldn't not feed him. Intellectually and in different circumstances, say the warm comfort of my office or an operating suite, I might talk about how I'd eat Napoleon in dire conditions. But in truth, now that I was in those dire conditions, I couldn't eat him. Every time I looked at him, he licked my face and wagged his tail. And every time the wind blew, he stood up, faced into it, and growled, "Anything with that tough a spirit deserves a chance." Others might have already carved him into dog steaks and filled up, but I just couldn't. He was probably tough as old shoe leather anyway. But to be honest, every time I looked at him, I saw Grover. Maybe that's reason enough. 6 or 7 hours later, with the first hint of daylight crawling across the gray and white mountains before us, my eyes cracked open to the unexpected sound of a hot, crackling fire. The meaning of the sound registered in my brain, and I shot upright, fearful that I'd set us on fire. I had not. Ashley was tending it, and had been for several hours. My clothes were warm, dry, and oddly enough, folded on top of a rock a few feet from the fire. She was poking at the fire with a long green evergreen limb, which she got from I don't know where. The ground around her sled was bare. She'd picked it clean. Anything within arm's reach had been thrown into the fire to keep it going. Now she was using the last of the sticks I'd gathered, which explained the crackling. My boots had been turned and the leather was dry, as were my socks. I stood there, rubbing my eyes, my boxers falling off my hips now that they were two sizes too big. "Hi." She pointed with her stick, the end of which was smoking. "You might think about buying down one or two sizes when we get out of here. Those are kind of big, and..." She made a little circle with her stick. "Buy some with a button fly. You selling hot dogs?" I covered up, rubbed my eyes, and lay back down. "I'd like some coffee, a cinnamon bun, 6 eggs over medium, a New York strip, some hash browns, more coffee, some orange juice, a piece of key lime pie, and a bowl of apple. No, make that peach cobbler." "Can I have some?" I sat up. "You didn't sleep much, did you?" She shrugged. "Couldn't. You were pretty tired, even talked in your sleep, and your clothes were dripping wet. I can't do much, but this," she circled the fire with her stick, "I can do." "Thanks. Really." I dressed, pulled on my warm boots, which brought a smile to my face, and grabbed the hatchet. "I'll be back." I returned a half hour later, arms full. I made 3 more trips. I'd heard that wives and mothers in African tribes can spend 3 to 10 hours a day, depending on conditions, searching for water and firewood. Now I understood why. I cranked the fire up, melted some snow, heated up some jerky, and fed both Ashley and Napoleon. She chewed quietly, pointing at the dog. "His ribs are showing." "Yeah. I think he'd like to be out of here." Her voice softened, betraying both humor and seriousness. "Me too." We were quiet a while. The fire felt good. "How's the leg?" She shrugged. I knelt, unzipped her bag, and ran my hand along her thigh. The swelling had decreased and the purple had quit spreading. Both good signs. She looked up at me while I stared at the stitches in her face. "I need to pull those out before the skin grows over them." She nodded. I pulled out my Swiss Army knife, snipped each stitch, and then began the rather painful and unpleasant experience of pulling them out. She held out her palm, and I laid each stitch into it. She winced, but never cried out. When I'd finished, she crossed her arms and asked, "How do I look?" "Nothing a good plastic surgeon can't fix."
"That bad?"
"Neosporin or vitamin E oil would be helpful once we get home. Lessen the scars."
"Vitamin E oil?"
"Yeah. Rachel used to have me put it on her stomach to reduce the stretch marks when she was pregnant with the twins."
"I'll bet they miss you."
"I miss them." She changed the subject.
"Don't know if you've had time to think about it yet, but what's the plan?"
"Shelter and food." I unconsciously looked at my watch, forgetting it was dead, and said, "We're on a bit of a plateau here. It continues another mile or so through trees like this, then drops off, if I remember right. I'd like to get there tonight, If it drops off, it drops off to something. I'm thinking a water source, lake, stream, something. Maybe we can haul up there a few days and give me a chance to find some food.
She eyed the bow, strapped to the top of the sled.
Are 6 arrows enough?
I shrugged. Don't have much choice.
I rubbed my chest.
My ribs feel better, but if I pull that thing all the way back, it stings a bit.
Grover's draw length was longer than mine, so it's harder for me to pull it and hold it back than it should be.
His what?
Draw length. Each bow fits the person shooting it. Like shoes. To a point, you can wear the wrong size, but it's not real comfortable. I stared out at the dark clouds rolling in across the peaks opposite us.
Looks like a snow day, and lots of it. I'd like to get through these trees before the worst of that drops on us.
She nodded.
I'm game.
We packed quickly, something we'd gotten good at, and I was back in the harness before I had time to dread it. I'd just strapped on my snowshoes and taken the first of several steps when she called from behind me.
Ben?
I stopped, not looking back.
Yeah.
She said it quieter this time.
Ben?
The tone of her voice was different. I turned and walked back to the sled, tangling myself in the straps.
Yeah?
She stared up out of the bag. The scar above her eye would heal, but it was pink and needed antibiotic ointment. She reached out, grabbed my hand. The denim strips from Grover's jacket were fraying and hung like dirty rags off my hands. My gloves had numerous holes, and my right index finger was sticking out. She grabbed my hand, rewrapping the denim strip around it.
You okay?
She was asking about more than just my feet or my stomach. I knelt and let out a deep breath. I'm okay as long as I don't think past the next step. Shook my head. Just one at a time. She nodded and braced herself for the constant shifting and banging on the sled. The snow didn't hold off. It began dropping quarter-sized flakes in the first hour. Walking the mile through the trees took us more than 3 hours. We emerged where a steep slope fell off into a valley of sorts. Of course, I was just guessing it was a valley, because given the total whiteout conditions, I had no real idea. We pulled up under the snow-weighted limbs of an evergreen, and I pulled out the sketch I'd made of the area. I guessed we were some 8 miles from the crash site, on the edge of a valley. I knew we'd walk down a 125-degree line, but we were also dodging to the right and left to skirt around rocks, ledges, small peaks, down to trees. We were probably 2 to 3 miles off our original azimuth, or line. This was to be expected, and there was little I could do about it. Walking a straight line in the wilderness is seldom possible. Walking in a straight direction is. But there's a big difference between straight line and straight direction. Both will take you in the same direction, but not to the same place. People experienced with reading compasses and who take it seriously, who engage in what's called orienteering, can overcome the side-to-side adjustments required by conditions and return to a straight line, allowing them to arrive at an actual predetermined point. I wasn't that good. Think of it this way. When we started, I set out on a given degree, 125. I then quickly bumped into a small peak that I could not climb, so we walked around. Once we got to the other side, I continued on our original heading, although we were now over a mile from that original line. It's something like walking on a grid. We can walk down one line, turn right, walk 3 squares, then turn back left and continue in our original direction. Only now we're 3 squares off our original line. While we were now 8 to 9 miles from the crash site, we'd probably walked close to twice that, given the back and forth that the conditions forced upon us. My sketch suggested we were 15 or 20 miles yet from the single line I'd seen on the GPS that might have been a logging road or hiker's trail or something. We were 14 days into this, and moving at a snail's pace. As much as I wanted to keep going, I needed to make a shelter and not move until we had more food. Without fuel, we wouldn't make it another few days. After that, I'd be too tired to hunt for it, With the hatchet, I cut into the tree that hid us and pulled down some limbs, giving us an entry on the lee side, and then laid those limbs on the windward side to give us more protection. I cut more limbs from a nearby tree, stacking them like vertical boards against the others, and hand-shoveled snow against the base. I fed the tips inside the limbs of our tree to hold them up, then inserted more cut limbs inside the limbs of our tree, sort of like rafters in an attic. Within an hour, we had a fair shelter. Ashley nodded.
Not bad.
I wouldn't want to live here, but it'll do in a pinch. I was dreading what came next. The bow drill. I gathered tinder, needles, and small twigs, and even shaved some fuzz off of one of my socks. I strung the bow and slowly began turning the spindle on the hearthboard. Once I developed the hole and cut the notch, I gave myself to fully working the bow. At this altitude, it took several minutes to get smoke. But once I got it, I kept tugging on the bow. 5 minutes in, I had a lot of smoke and felt like I might have enough to make a coal. I set down the bow and spindle, picked up my hearthboard, and studied my coal. It might work. I lifted it, blew gently, and a small red ember appeared. I blew again and blew too hard. It scattered like dust. I started over. This time, I pulled on the bow for 8 or 9 minutes, making sure I had ample dust to create a coal. Anyone who's ever done this will tell you that 8 or 9 minutes is a long time. Experienced bow drillers can do this whole thing from start to finish in 2 minutes or less. I was not that experienced. I set down the bow, lifted the hearth, blew gently, blew again, and this time smoke curled up. I blew some more, turning the coal red, then placed it gently inside my handful of tinder, needles, and sock fuzz while trying not to scatter the dust that was my coal. I blew some more, blew some more, blew some more. Finally, a small flame. I blew into it, the flame spread and grew, and I set the handful of coal inside my teepee of sticks and twigs. We had a fire. Ashley lay there shaking her head. You're better than Robinson Crusoe. You just made a fire without a match or gas or anything. How do you know how to do all this? When I was in my residency in Denver, learning how to cut on people? Actually, I'd already learned that on cadavers, but I was doing a good bit of it. A smile. Rachel and I were spending more and more time in the mountains. Might call it cheap entertainment. Anyway, she had this wild idea that on one of our next trips, we weren't taking anything with us that could make a fire. No matches, no lighter fluid, no gasoline, no camp stove, and certainly no jet boil. She said we were doing this the old-fashioned way. If we couldn't make it hot, we were staying cold. So I bought some books, read up on it, looked at the pictures and tried it out a few times, even called a local scoutmaster to give me some lessons. We went camping, and I figured out what did and didn't work. In part, I learned how to make a fire.
Remind me to thank her when I meet her, Ashley pointed at me. Where'd you learn to hold your mouth like that?
What do you mean?
Whenever you're concentrating on something, you make this face. She flexed one side of her face, looked like a string had been threaded through her right eyebrow, down through her cheek, and secured to the corner of her lip, then pulled up about 3 inches. Like that.
Does it look as painful as when you do it?
I don't know. Does it look painful?
Very.
Probably not. You make it look more stupid-looking.
Thanks. I'll remember that next time you need help with the necessaries.
She laughed. Do your nurses make fun of you?
I turned up the right side of my face. They can't see it beneath the mask.
She lay back, closing her eyes. Quiet settled around us, and I realized that I had grown used to the sound of her voice. And for the first time, the silence caused me to wonder if I missed it when it wasn't ringing through the air.
Since our shelter was made entirely from evergreens, it smelled fresh, clean. This is about the most eco-friendly house I've ever stayed in, she laughed.
Yep, real green.
It was warm and comfortable, and the limbs above did a good job of providing shelter while also drawing the smoke out. It was late afternoon now, but with 2 hours of daylight left, I pulled on my jacket, tied on my snowshoes, and grabbed the bow. I'm going to take a look about.
Be gone long?
An hour, maybe. I looked at Napoleon.
Be right back. Keep her company.
He turned in a circle and hid himself in her sleeping bag.
One problem with a shelter like the one I just made is that people who make them get inside, get comfortable, make a fire, and then set the whole thing aflame, bringing it down on top of themselves.
Given her leg, Ashley wouldn't be able to dig herself out, making a really bad situation. I pointed my finger at her.
Mind the fire. Don't let it get too big. You do, and you'll set our Christmas tree on fire, which would include you because I doubt you could dig yourself out.
You're pretty well barricaded in here.
And keep that snow close at hand. If the fire gets too big, throw a few handfuls on top.
Not too much. Don't want to kill it. Just scale it back a bit.
Agreed?
She nodded, made a snowball, and threw it at me.
I climbed up a small ridge. The lee side was sheltered from the wind, so the snow cover was less. Sprigs of dead grass and ice-covered rock spotted the snow like bubble gum on a sidewalk.
Maybe bird droppings was more like it.
My lungs told me we were still above 10,000 feet. The air was thin, and even though we'd been at this for 2 weeks, I wasn't used to it. Still caught myself taking deep breaths when sitting still. I guess that comes from living at sea level. It was easier, but it wasn't easy. The snow had quit and clouds had flown through. The sky was gray, but the ceiling was high and I could see the whole valley stretched out before us. The ridgeline I was on made a half moon, which circled a larger valley below, maybe 10 to 15 square miles in total. Frozen creeks and small streams creased between the trees, making wrinkles in the earth's face. Except for the occasional rise and roll or pitch of a hill, it was mostly flat. Flat around here was a relative term, but it was certainly better than where we'd been. A couple hundred yards from our shelter, I reached a small ledge, sat down, zipped up my jacket against the wind, and studied the landscape. I cupped my hands around my eyes to help me focus, and scanned every square acre, asking myself if anything I saw hinted at the possibility that it might be man-made. I did this until I grew cold, and the light started growing dim. Just as the light was fading, I caught a flash of something brown. It looked like the trunk of a tall tree, except it was horizontal near the treetops. I squinted, even stared out of the sides of my vision, trying to get a better view. It was hard to make out, but worth a second look. I opened my compass, took a reading of 97 degrees, and turned the plastic marker on the face of the compass to 97 degrees. It paid to be redundant. I started back to camp as darkness was falling. 20 yards in front of me, something white flashed across my trail. I knocked an arrow and waited for any sign of movement. 5 minutes I waited, then a small hop, followed by another. There, a small rabbit. Big ears, big feet, hunched over and hopping beneath the trees. I drew, settled the first pin in the middle of the rabbit, let out half a breath, and squeezed the release. Just as the arrow left the bow, the rabbit hopped maybe 6 inches. My arrow sailed by harmlessly and buried itself in the snow. The rabbit bounced twice and disappeared. I searched for my arrow, but digging in the snow was painful to my blistered and cracking hands. I decided to leave it until tomorrow. Ashley had the fire warm and crackling when I returned. She'd even managed to boil some water and heat up what was getting close to the last of our meat. Maybe a day left. She eyed the bow and the single arrow missing.
What happened?
It hopped.
And if it hadn't?
I'm pretty sure we'd be eating rabbit tonight.
Maybe from now on you should let me hold them still while you shoot them.
If you can catch them, I'm game for anything.
She laughed.
Say, do you feel like taking a walk?
She raised her eyebrows.
Seriously?
Yeah, if you can lean on me, I think we could make our way up to this ridge. I need your eyes.
See something?
Maybe. Maybe not. Hard to say. I'm not willing to risk it without both of us looking at it.
What are we risking?
I had thought we'd keep trying to lose elevation, but this thing I'm looking at would keep us on this plateau for a few miles. It's a 2 or 3 day change in direction, followed by another 3 or 4 to make up for lost ground. 7 days out of the way if I'm wrong. I didn't need to tell her that we were flirting with the edge as it was. Another week could kill us. We might be dead already and not know it.
What is it?
Not sure. Looks something like a tree, only it's lying flat at the level of the treetops. It's a horizontal line in a sea of verticals.
Is it safe for me to walk?
No, and the sled would never make it. We'll take it slow. One step at a time.
I trust you, if you think we ought to.
It's not about trust. It's about 4 eyes are better than 2.
When you want to go?
First light. The rising sun may be our best chance. Taking Ashley to the ledge was risky, but so was deciding our direction. When we first left the crash site, it was anybody's guess. But now that we were committed and too far from the site to backtrack, we needed to make this together. Because I could see where the next week of walking would take us. Our living and our dying rested to a great extent on which direction we headed. I also knew we needed a break. We climbed into our bags and watched the flame light the underside of the tree limbs. It was the first time I'd been overly warm and had to unzip my bag. Once I got some food in me, I moved my attention to Ashley's leg. Swelling was down, and knotting and scar tissue were discernible around the break. All good signs. I sat opposite her, placed her good foot on my lap, and began rubbing deep into her arch, then her calf, finally her hamstring and quadriceps to force the circulation. She looked at me.
You sure you didn't study massage?
You've been lying prostrate for 2 weeks. We need to get the blood flowing. You try to stand up on these things, and you're liable to look like a weeble.
A what?
A weeble, you know. Weebles wobble, but they don't fall down. I worked my thumb into the side of her right buttock. It was painful, and she winced, finally letting out a deep breath, and the muscle relaxed. You can look at someone and think one thing, but you put your hands on them, and you really get to know what they're made of. Ashley was all muscle. Long, lean, limber muscle, which probably saved her life. A normal person would have folded in the fuselage. I gently moved to her left foot, careful not to torque her leg. I just needed to get into the muscle of her foot and calf, forcing blood flow. I'd hate for you to get angry and kick me when your leg heals. You're nothing but one big muscle.
Don't feel like much of one lying here.
It'll come back. A few weeks and you'll be good as new.
Your wife a good runner?
First time I saw her in high school, I thought it was the most fluid thing I'd ever seen. Like watching water walk. Just floated across the infield. Her toes barely touched the ground. She flinched as I worked deep into her calf.
When we get back, you've got to teach Vince how to do this.
She tossed her head back and held her breath. Letting it out, she said,
Seriously, how did you learn to do this?
Rachel and I continued to run races through med school. By default, we became each other's trainer, which she needed because she inherited some funny feat from her mom.
What do you mean?
I touched the outside of her foot, just below her big toe.
Bunions.
You actually rubbed that woman's bunions? I drove my thumb hard into her arch, curling her toes.
You find that hard to believe?
She shook her head.
That's some serious sick love right there.
Vince doesn't rub your feet?
Not even if I gave him rubber gloves.
I better talk to that man.
She snapped her fingers. That's a good idea. And while you're making a list, add that little thing you did with the stick and making the fire.
I shook my head and smiled.
Nope. Why not?
I slid her sock back on and placed her foot inside the bag. Because I think I'd convince him to do something else first. What's that?
Buy a satellite phone.
I'm not sure which was better, the fire or the sound of her giggling. Chapter 26. Warmed by the fire, I lay awake, staring at the ironic side of another jetliner at 30,000 feet. Ashley was out, slightly snoring. A gentle breeze filtered through our tree, pulled on the limbs above us, and added extra twinkle to a sky lit by 10 billion stars. Tomorrow's decision was worrying me. Had I really seen something, or, after 15 days, had I wanted to so badly that my mind convinced my eyes that I had? The sound woke me. Feet crunching snow. Sounded like two people standing outside our tree grunting, smacking their lips. Whatever it was had to be heavy, too, because when it crunched snow, it really crunched the snow, packing it hard. I reached out to touch Ashley, but her hand met mine in the middle. I climbed out of my bag, grabbed the bow, knocked an arrow, and crouched between Ashley and the door. Her hand rested on the back of my neck. My smoke blew white mist in clouds that filtered up. The cold had returned. Goosebumps crawled up and down my skin. Less than 5 feet away, the thing circled around behind us, sniffing, grunting, and then I heard the knock of something hard on something else. Antlers. I heard antlers rubbing against the tree limbs. I took a deep breath and relaxed. Ashley picked up on it and took her hands off my neck. The thing snorted, snorted again, then grunted loudly, scaring us both, and took off running. I laid down the bow and climbed back into my bag. Ashley broke the silence.
Ben?
Yeah.
You mind sleeping over here?
Sure. I picked up my bag and slid it over next to her right side. She slid down in her bag, only her eyes and lips exposed, and drifted off. I lay awake, listening, watching my breath rise like smoke signals. It reminded me of Disney's Peter Pan and the song, What Makes a Red Man Red? I guess I sang it a little while, making myself laugh. It must have been the altitude mixed with the hunger. Sometime later, I woke again. There was hair in my face, human hair, and it smelled of woman. Single hairs were tickling my nose. Others felt silky on my face. My first tendency was to move, slide over, respect her space. But I did not. I lay there, breathing in, stealing the aroma. Slow inhales followed by long, quiet exhales. Remembering what a woman smelled like. And I liked it. Ashley turned her head, pressing her forehead to mine, her breath on my face. I pressed in and slowly filled my lungs. Then, careful not to wake her, I did it again. I did that a long time. Somewhere in there I drifted off, feeling guilty and filled with longing. It was dark when I woke. The moon was high and bright because it filtered through the evergreen limbs above me and cast a needled shadow across the snow. The fire had died, but coals remained. I blew on them, turned them red, added tinder, and had a flame in seconds. Ashley stirred. The firelight threw finger shadows across her face. She was thin and had lost a lot of weight, maybe 20 pounds. Her eyes were sunken, circled in black. The whites of her eyes were red road maps, and her breath was bad, meaning her body was eating itself from the inside out. Mine wasn't any better. I dressed, helped her do the same, and once I had her bundled, slid her out the entrance. I could only pull the sled about 100 yards before the angle grew too steep and I had to lift her to a standing position. She wrapped an arm around my neck. I put her on my right side so her bad leg was between us. She winced as the weight of her foot pulled on the brake.
That does not feel good.
You want to sit down? Go back? She shook her head.
No, let's keep going.
We took our time. One step, then another. Napoleon trailed behind, hopping in our footsteps, happy to be out. Ashley wrapped her right arm around my neck and clung to my right hand with hers, locking us stride for stride. What had taken me 20 minutes took us nearly an hour, but we made it without incident. I sat her on the ledge, the views spread out before us, and she scanned the 60 or 70 square miles looking back at us. She nodded. Under different circumstances, this would be beautiful. I leveled the compass on my leg, let the needle settle, then pointed across the carpet of evergreens toward a distant mountain ridge. See that brown-looking thing? Sort of flat, stretched left to right, sitting on top of the trees, just left of that white-capped ridgeline? Napoleon hopped up into my lap, staring down in the valley. She cupped her hands around her eyes. They're all white-capped. I waited while she studied the horizon. We were looking at a speck some 8 to 10 miles distant, the proverbial needle. See it? She nodded. Yeah. She was quiet a minute. How in the world did you see that in the first place? Don't know. It's hard to make out. Give it about 10 minutes. When direct sunlight starts coming over the ridges, it'll light on whatever that is. If it's man-made, we'll get some sort of reflection that's unnatural. So, we waited, trying not to look at it so much that it lost all meaning. Like a word you say over and over again until you're only hearing what it sounds like and you've forgotten what it means. Sunlight crawled down the mountain summit and into the valley, pushing a dim shadow before it. As it did, it uncovered what lay before us, an immense valley, hemmed on three sides by steep and jagged mountains. In the middle floated an evergreen sea, crisscrossed by streams and small frozen lakes and ponds. Many of the trees were dead. Thousands, naked of bark and whitened by the sun, stood as silent sentinels. Those that had fallen spread across the forest in an angled, twisted maze of biblical proportions.
What's the name of that game where you take a handful of straws, stack them up straight, and then just let them fall away in a messy pile?
Pick up sticks?
That's it.
I waved my hand across the green sea before me. Looks like God was playing a giant game of pickup sticks and got called away right as it started. She laughed. Just before the sun grew too bright and the reflection of the snow obscured the image we were looking at, the brown thing glimmered, or shimmered, with maybe a sparkling reflection below it. I asked without turning my head, "You see that?" "Yeah. I'm not sure whether it was a reflection off ice or snow or something else." "Okay. Look right. You see that clearing?" "Yep. Could be a frozen lake."
"What's your point?"
"Well, if it was me, and I was to build a mountain house or camp or something, and I really wanted to get away, I'd come up here to this plateau, preferably near a lake, and build."
"I can see that."
The sun rose, grew bright, and the glare painful, obscuring our view. I prompted her, "What do you think?" I pointed down our original line, which would take us to lower elevation and out of the valley we were looking into. "Going that way is lower elevation, probably warmer. Certainly breathe easier. Just don't know where it leads or how long it will take us to get there." I swung a wide arc left, across the valley toward the image in the distance. "Across the valley of pickup sticks is a lot of deep snow, trees, frozen creeks hidden beneath the surface that could swallow me. If that thing over there is nothing, then it's going to cost us the distance of going over, then trudging a vector back across the other side of this thing to the break in the mountains, where it looks like we can get down to a lower elevation."
"This is called a dilemma," she said.
I nodded.
"How much food do we have?"
"If we stretch it?"
"Yes."
"Maybe a day's worth, day and a half, if we don't mind being hungry."
"How long can you make it after it runs out?"
"I can keep breathing for maybe a week, but my energy level will be fading. If I'm pulling the sled..." I shrugged. "I'm not sure."
"Sounds to me like
Absent another sudden influx of food, we've got enough energy to get into the valley and then across it on what's stored up inside you right now. And if we make it to the other side without finding food, then it might be a good place to curl up and go to sleep for a long time.
If you want to put it that way.
You got a better way?
Not really.
What if you left me here and scouted it out on your own?
I've thought about that. Granted, I could get there a lot quicker, but there's no guarantee that I could do it safely or that I could get back to you.
If I fall, get hurt, get eaten by a mountain lion, then you'll never know, and we'll both die alone with a lot of unanswered questions. I'm not willing to risk that. What if I am?
It's not your choice.
How do you figure?
'Cause I'm the one who has to walk across that, then walk back, not you.
What if I asked you to?
I'd refuse.
Why?
Let's say I get over there, stand on top of that ridge line and see a house or a road or something, anything, on the other side. Then I've got to make the decision to head for that, taking me several more days from you. By the time I found help and returned, you'd never know it because you'd be dead.
But you would have made it.
I shook my head. I won't risk that.
I thought we were in this together.
We are, which is why I'm not leaving here without you.
I stared at her.
Ashley, this is no game we're playing. We, both of us, are either going this way or that way. It's either or, not maybe and what if.
She closed her eyes, squeezing out tears. Then she spoke without looking at me. We've been at this for 15 days.
At some point, we're just prolonging the inevitable.
If that's the case, and you can go a lot further without me, then you've got to try it. One of us making it is better than both of us dying.
That's where you're wrong. I won't do it.
What if I won't go with you? What if I fight you?
Then I'll thump you on the head, strap you to your sled, and haul you out under objection.
Now, that's enough. I'm not leaving you.
We sat side by side, staring out over a painful future.
She hooked her arm inside mine and laid her head on my shoulder. Why are you doing this?
I have my reasons.
One of these days you've got to help me understand them because they don't make any sense.
I stood and pulled her onto 2 feet.
That depends. On what?
Whether you're looking at this through my eyes or yours.
We began walking back down. Gingerly, she set 1 foot in front of the other, clinging to me. Halfway back, I let her rest while I dug out my arrow.
We look like 2 people in a potato sack race, she said through a running nose.
I nodded, watching where she put her foot. If she slipped, her reflexes would kick in and she'd attempt to brace herself for the broken leg. If she did, she'd pass out from the pain. I was hoping to prevent that.
She clung to me, breathing deeply.
2 weeks on her back had caught up to her.
I've got to stop, she said.
She turned and faced me. 2 kids dancing. She laughed.
Are you going to slide your hands into my jean pockets?
No. But we do make a good team.
She nodded. If Vince and I had tried walking from here to that ledge, we'd have ended up on our backs with me in a lot of pain, trying to choke him by shoving snow down his throat for letting me fall.
Not to pry, but every time you talk about him, you tell me how you two are different, not alike.
Not compatible. What's up with that?
We're different, all right. But I enjoy him. He makes me laugh. And we have a lot in common.
People go to the rescue shelter and choose dogs for similar reasons, not 70-year soulmates.
Okay, Dr. Phil, what reason would you choose?
Love.
She shook her head. That kind only happens to the select few. The rest of us better get what we can while we can. Otherwise...
Otherwise what?
Otherwise we end up waiting on a fairy tale that never comes true.
What if you could have the fairy tale, but getting it means waiting for it.
What? Like Pretty Woman?
Somebody's been trying to sell me that my whole life. I've looked for him. Waited. Tried to be selective. Not hopping on the first train that came through the station, but I'm just not buying. All the good ones are taken. Guys like Grover and you.
I've never had much luck finding one of them.
I'm just saying, I think you're...
I'm what?
Selling yourself short if you settle for a marriage that is less than what you'd hoped for.
You deserve more.
Better.
Ben Payne, are you flirting with me?
No, I'm just saying I think you're quite remarkable. And if Vince isn't... If he's not remarkable and he doesn't light you up, then, with all due respect to him, don't marry him.
That's easy for you to say. You've been married 15 years and don't have to look at the prospect of shopping in a market where demand is high and supply is low. And it's not that Vince doesn't light me up.
I never said it was easy. I just think you deserve something or someone stellar.
She smiled. Thank you. I'll remember that. She reached up and scratched my beard.
You've got some gray in there.
Time does that, along with...
With what?
Hard miles on the chassis. We reached the shelter and I replayed our conversation. My words hit me like a brick. The tables had turned. Time and mileage had done that too. I packed the sled, got her settled back in her bag and strapped in. Ashley stopped me.
You okay? You look pale.
I nodded, but didn't look at her. My face would have betrayed me. Chapter 27. We left the shelter and set out. The snow was frozen, hard on top, making my pulling easy. Ashley was quiet, tired. She didn't look good. Gaunt, hollow. She needed nutrients. Her body was working double time trying to survive and feed the wounds inside her. In the light, I studied the tracks outside, and they confirmed what I'd thought. Moose. I cursed myself for not slipping out and trying a shot with the bow. Even a small moose could have fed us for weeks. Ashley heard me and said,
"You didn't know what it was. What if it had been a grizzly bear?"
"Probably be dead."
"Then you were right in your decision."
"Yeah, but we could be eating right now." She nodded.
"Yep, and that grizzly would be licking his claws after he had you for dinner and me for dessert."
I stared at her.
"Do you watch horror movies?"
"No. Why?"
"You're kind of morbid in your thinking."
"I started out as a writer for a local rag covering the crime beat. Guess I've seen too many pictures of what happened to people who suspected it was not what it was. Sometimes it's better not to go investigate the noise down the hall."
I set Napoleon on her chest, and he kissed me on the face.
I adjusted the little booty things around his feet and scratched his head. He turned, dug himself into the bag, and disappeared. I turned, fastened my harness, and began pulling. Of all the days we'd had thus far, this promised to be the longest. Toward lunchtime, we'd made maybe 2 miles, a good distance, but it had taken its toll on me. Ashley broke the silence.
"Hey, why don't you rest a while?"
I stopped, hands on my knees, breathing down into my belly and nodded. "Sounds good." I unbuckled myself and then pushed the sled over toward a small flat area between 2 trees. I stepped and had no time to react. The false top gave way, bent both snowshoes nearly in two, and swallowed me to my neck. The impact knocked the wind out of me, jolting my ribs. Water rushed over my feet, shins, even my knees. My lungs felt full even though I was out of breath. Reflexively, I turned and grabbed for anything to stop my falling. I caught the sled. Doing so, it turned on its side and threw Ashley and Napoleon out of it, screaming and whimpering. I pulled, dragging myself from the sucking hole in the stream beneath. Every foothold gave way, and whenever I pulled with my right side, the pain in my chest peaked and sent spasms through me. I paused,
gathering myself, and pulled once, and again, and again, slowly inching myself from the hole. The wet snow acted like quicksand. I pulled my body up on top of the snow, beaching myself. Ashley lay several feet away, breathing deeply, tense, hands fisted, knuckles white, lips taut. I crawled to her, studying her pupils. Shock would show up there first. She darted a glance, then returned her attention to some speck in the sky she had focused on, something she learned in taekwondo. I was drenched from the waist down. We were hurt, had no fire, I couldn't get dry, and we couldn't get across this valley of hell for at least another day. I could walk in wet clothes. They'd freeze, which was better than clinging to me wet. But wet boots were another thing. I turned, looked at the sled. There was a hole in it. When I'd grabbed it, flipped it over, and thrown Ashley out, it had caught on something that tore a large hole in the area just beneath Ashley's shoulders. I propped her head up, unzipped her bag, and carefully studied her leg. The throw had not rebroken it. The angle of her foot had not changed. But it had torqued all the tender attachments and tacky bones that had slowly been resettling and regrowing. It was swelling right before my eyes. Our options were few. I could dig a snow cave and we could get in, crawl into our bags and hole up. But that only delayed the problem. When we crawled out, my clothes and, more important, my boots would still be wet or frozen. We'd be no further along and that much hungrier. My core was okay. My jacket was wadded up nicely inside Ashley's bag, but I had no spare pair of socks because both of mine were currently on my feet, keeping me warm. Or were. And the bottom, most critical part of the sled, now had a hole in it. If I tried to pull her, the sled would dig in, becoming a plow. If I could get dry feet, get them warm and keep them dry, I could walk through the cold in my legs. The only other pair of dry socks was currently on Ashley's feet. The question then was how to keep them dry, and more important, how to fix the sled. I sank my head in my hands. If our situation had been bad an hour ago, maybe even dire, it was now circling the bowl of unimaginable. I didn't have a solution, but I knew I had to get moving. My teeth were starting to chatter. I sat up, pulled off my gaiters, then my boots, and both pairs of socks. I know you probably don't feel like talking to me right now, but can I borrow your socks? She nodded. Her knuckles were still white. I slipped them off her feet, wrapped her feet in my jacket, and then zipped her gently back inside her bag. Both sleeping bags came inside what are called stuff sacks. With down bags, it's paramount to keep them dry or they lose all insulating ability. So most good bags come stuffed inside a dry sack, which is almost entirely waterproof. I pulled both sacks out of my pack, stuffed my sleeping bag back into the backpack, slid on Ashley's socks, slid my feet into the dry sacks, tightened the compression straps around my calves, loosened the laces on my boots, slid my feet in, laced them up, and then put my gaiters on beneath my pant legs. A poor solution, but the only one I can think of at the moment. I took a few steps. It felt like I was walking in moon boots. I looked at my snowshoes and decided they were not salvageable. Both had bent in the middle, crimping the frames. They were one step from breaking in two. The sled was a much larger problem. Ashley's leg had to remain flat. I couldn't just pick her up and carry her, because the pressure of my forearm beneath her femur, aside from being excruciatingly painful, could re-break it. A sled was essential. I needed something to patch the hole. I had nothing but a backpack and two bent snowshoes. The snowshoes caught my eye. The nets I'd used as the base of the snowshoes had been double-folded when I'd first made them, in order to support my weight. If I unfolded them... I did, and fastened the sides to either side of the sled. Doing so prevented Ashley from slipping through the hole, but it did not prevent snow from gushing through. My only option was to lift one end of the sled and tie it to me via the harness. This lifted Ashley's head and shoulders off the snow, and meant I dragged the back end,
making two deep drag marks in the snow, like railroad tracks.